Okay. Okay, any questions, folks? Come on. You have to argue with me, surely. No arguments? Yeah, no discussions? No debates? Well, darling, go. Yeah, go. Yeah, whoever wants.
I'm quite interested in the daily life sort of thing, so I was really interested if we can kind of get rid of all of our attachments, or get rid of our attachments. I'm really interested in then the kind of the compassion wing and how to build on that. So when you started talking about the generosity and practical notions, I'm just wondering, is there more on that side, on the
as opposed to
compassion, as opposed to the delusions and attachments? So you talk about the compassion wing and the wisdom wing.
That's
so
right.
I'm just curious about the compassion wing and
exactly
how that can play in the day to day, the everyday out there.
Exactly. But it's true. But I mean, the point of talking about the wisdom wing, can you see? I mean, obviously you do, but just spell it out to me. Why are we talking about the delusions?
Because unless we've unraveled these barriers, we're not capable of helping others.
That's right. Exactly.
So,
and that's enormous in itself.
It's huge.
If you can imagine that you're less neurotic and less needy and less depressed and less angry,
absolutely,
you just naturally will be empathetic with the ant, the dog, the human, whoever's in front of you, and you'll already have more clarity and more wisdom about how to help them because you'll know your own mind.
Agree.
Exactly.
And I think part of my struggle, yes, my questioning is, that there's a certain amount of internal gazing, yeah, in there. And
what
so,
do you mean? Sorry, what do you mean?
But in terms of looking at my irritations, my anger, my resentments, my attachments, mm-hmm, my grasping, etc. So, mm-hmm, so that, you know, it becomes a me world that I'm really interested in.
But it's necessary.
I understand it's necessary, and I'd like to be thinking about, okay, so outside of all that, how do I build my compassion wing?
By doing the wisdom wing. And yeah, I'm really not being sarcastic. We will talk more. There's no question we'll talk more about the overt techniques of how to increase your empathy with others. Mm. We've already touched upon equanimity with absolute certainty. Yeah. But I think, of course it's internal. But don't think of it self-centered. And it's sort of implying that. And that's misunderstanding it. That's like...
No, I think the reason I'm here,
yes,
I see it, and it's almost then we have this energy, and it's what to do with it.
What do you mean, this energy?
This desire to help others, to something to do with once.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be sarcastic. I'm not trying to deny what you're saying, and I'm not trying to be defensive. But you can't. But what we're doing? Okay. Let's just say you're saying, I'm yearning to help people fix their eyes. I can see all these people with cataracts and they're all blind, and you're full of this energy to help people fix their eyes, right? You have to sit there and watch your navel for 5 years studying the bloody eyes. You're not even able to look at even a single person. And people will say, look at that selfish girl sitting there reading books, worrying about what the nature of an eye is and why this and why the eyelash that and the something else pupil this. Because you're learning and studying. You mightn't even help a single person in those few years. Maybe you'll have a little bit because you're not qualified. So as you learn more about the mind, as you learn more about your delusions, as you learn to see what it is preventing you from even knowing yourself, as you learn to know what is causing you suffering, you even might go to do 5-year retreat. You're not watching your navel, baby. You're getting rid of the shit that's preventing you from seeing others. And I know you know that, but just hear it again. It's not talking about the compassion wing. Why are you sitting in the mountains watching you doing your work on your mind? Why are you sitting there at university reading a book looking like so selfish? So that you are qualified to help people about their eyes or their mind. So it's utterly integrated. It's utterly part of it. And you just, the way you said before, there's a little bit of navel gazing, you said, something like that, which implies it's wasting time. Yeah. So what are you doing reading that book? You're such a selfish person. All those people out there with their cataracts, how come you're not out there helping them? That's exactly what you're saying.
I don't think it's exactly what I'm saying, but there is something of that movement. It's that movement from self to other. And maybe, you know, I'm sitting here waiting for it to happen.
No, who? When? This is a really good discussion. What do you mean you're waiting for what to happen?
The other thing that kind of came up was that we can live in this life of comfort. So in a sense, having kind of removed the delusion, I can live in the world in a more compassionate way, with a greater depth of contentment and happiness than I've ever had before, and it's marvellous. And I can be giving to those people around me and helping the people around me, giving the time, giving my energy, etc. And there's something about, what's next? Yeah, how... There's loads more that I have to do in order to understand how I can help people, even but with what I have something to offer. And I don't know, maybe I'm in the wrong place, but this isn't the place. It's like, maybe I just have to go and find something. But when you were talking really pragmatically about the generosity model, you know, like just do that. That's like really practical, pragmatic advice.
Okay.
Looking at the divisions and my attachments.
So that's not pragmatic advice. So that's not pragmatic advice, is what you're suggesting.
Hmm?
So you're suggesting that working on your delusions isn't pragmatic advice.
Yes, it's very pragmatic advice.
So therefore, why aren't you happy with that? So why aren't you happy with that and just keep moving and knowing it's all there? It's a path. Listen, honey, let me tell you what you'll be like when you're a bodhisattva. Shall I tell you that?
Hmm.
Using this model. You want to help a few people, okay? By the time you fully develop your consciousness, your mind will pervade the universe. It will know the minds of all sentient beings, their past, present, and future. You'll have infinite empathy with every single one as if they're you, because there's no longer a separate sense of self. And you'll be able to manifest your mind in trillions of bodies throughout trillions of universes to help trillions of sentient beings for trillions of eons. So be a bit patient, okay? I mean, of course I get your point.
Do you?
Just wait. Hang on a tick. Hang on a tick. Let me just finish with her. No, I mean, I'm not arguing with what you're saying, but you just got to not... Okay, just keep moving. How about that? And then maybe you won't get what you need in the Buddha's teachings, and that's fine. That's fine too. But there's plenty of stuff, pragmatic advice, as you're saying. Equanimity was one of them. That's the starting point. But this is a preliminary to it. And the degree to which you can even get equanimity, which is the first of these 11 techniques, which would culminate in this bodhicitta, even the ability to which you can even able to see friend, enemy, and stranger as equal, that is already beyond profound. You couldn't get anything more pragmatic than that. So there's a piece of advice there. It's enough to go and meditate for 1 year on it to try and realize that alone. Generosity is even more advanced, when eventually you can give your entire life, you know. You can. But yeah, I hear you, but just keep listening, maybe. It's okay. You understand? What's he saying, darling? Go.
I'm doing the I. Am I deluded in how far I think I am along the path?
I can't possibly imagine, but that's up to you. This is part of our big problem, I think. Like if you're learning music and you think you're in grade 2.5 and you're only in grade 1, 2.25, you're deluded. You've got to know exactly where you're at and where you've come from and how far you're going. Then you're really on track.
And how do you get to the point where really know where you are?
How do you get to... Okay, really good question. Again, let's look at a simple example of you're studying music and you've got Bach's music there and you're playing Bach. How will you know what you've accomplished? What will be the guideline you'd use to help you know confidently what you've accomplished? How would you judge yourself?
Being able to play a piece.
Right, so there's a piece of piano. There's a piece of music right on your piano.
Yeah.
And it's... These nice musicians have packaged these pieces in terms of the levels, haven't they? So you've got a grade 5 piece there. You'll know immediately if you're at that level, won't you, by just whether you can play it or not. It's exactly the same here, but we're not used to thinking of it like that, as so in such a graded way, you know? So you'll...
Sorry,
go on.
When you read a text, you know, I can read a text and think I understand it, but
you
without
have,
being able to qualify that with somebody who actually knows the text and what that means, how do I know that I have interpreted the text correctly?
By hearing the instructions, by listening to the teachings, by studying, by meditating, by working through it in a very sincere way, just like you would with music. There's no difference. There's no difference.
Is this why you need a qualified teacher?
Well, honey, I think we're talking uncharted territory here. We're talking about developing your mind to the point where you can do unbelievable things. If you need a teacher to show you music and math, I would suggest that it's a no-brainer. You need teachers in this. Otherwise, we just go berserk, just wander off and lose the plot completely, which is what we think of as spiritual anyway. Absolutely, darling. Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Any more questions? No. More leaks? Where's the other leak coming from?
No, it's the same.
Oh, it's the same
leak. Same area, yes.
Oh, okay. Any more points to bring up? Yes.
Slightly tangential, perhaps, but you were talking about the 10 non-virtuous actions, and it just occurred to me that the ones of the mind, how is wrong views an action?
I understand. We haven't even discussed those yet. Everything you do is a karma or an action. Some are mental and some are verbal and some are physical. The word karma means mind, means action. It means action, not just physical and verbal. They're not the only things that are actions, it's mental actions. So, yeah. So really one way to put that, there are these seven little things that Buddha would exhort us to try and refrain from doing to at least begin the process of harnessing our body and speech. And then the way I like to think of it, he just begins to get us to start looking into the mind by refraining from these grosser levels of the three root delusions, the grosser levels of the three poisons. But they're actions, technically. Mental actions. Okay. What else, people? So, okay, what have we talked about so far?
Today.
Oh, self question. What happened? I'm about to answer myself. We kind of touch on the big picture, the overview, showing all the different stages, junior school, high school, university, postgraduate, if you like, this path. We talked on the first two lots are the wisdom wing and then you've got the compassion wing. The compassion wing is the point. The compassion wing is the point. But and then if you take this gradual way of looking at it, you know, abiding, the essence of junior school is abiding by the laws of karma, refraining from harming the sentient beings with your body and speech, and learning to begin to work on your mind. Then you get to high school, you start to really do the hard, you start to really get some concentration, learn using this technique, developing this concentration, and then start to unpack and unravel the contents of your mind. And this is, all this, if you like, is what I just said now, is like the retreat mode. Really intense, doing the work of ridding the mind of all the pollution, all the rubbish, the stuff that causes you suffering, and crucially, the stuff that prevents you from seeing and knowing how to help others. Then you've got the compassion wing, which is university level. So the difference is if you're doing, you know, grade one, junior school music and high school music and university music, if you're only in grade one, you can't even pretend to try to play university music. It'll be too complicated. But here, in a way, they are gradual, but you can practice any one of these. Like, you know, you just said, you can practice generosity according to your capacity right now. You don't have to wait till you've accomplished junior school, high school, the wisdom wing until you actually begin the compassion wing. You know, in any one day, You could, for example, Tantra, Vajrayana, that's postgraduate, the most advanced, the most sophisticated level of Buddhist psychology and philosophy and practice, the most advanced. But in one day, you would practice any one of these, but you would do it according to your level. So that's another whole point as well. So if you're an ordinary person who hasn't given up attachment and anger and delusions and who hasn't realized emptiness and doesn't even have much renunciation of suffering and its causes at all, you can still try to be generous. But your generosity will necessarily be very limited. It's like playing the university piece in a very simple, limited way. You don't wait till you've accomplished those before you even begin, but you do it according to your capacity. So that's where you have to really learn to know the difference between intellectually knowing something and experientially knowing it. And that's where it's different from music. I mean, you can learn musical theory, but you know as soon as you get to the piano, if you can't play it, then you haven't accomplished yet. You could learn the theory really brilliantly. You could even teach someone else musical theory in the most advanced level, but you're not very good at playing it yourself. That's a possibility, isn't it? Do you understand my point? What's your name, darling?
Louise.
Do you get that point? That's a possibility. But you can never fool yourself you've realised the theory because you know you can't play it. But it's easier to fool yourself intellectually than when you think about impermanence, which you can teach even another class on the perfect teachings on Buddhist impermanence, all from the text, blah, blah, blah. But you can easily fool yourself that you've realised impermanence experientially. And that's the big difference. So as you study and as you learn, and you know, there are various criteria of how you determine what a realization is. So impermanence, one way of putting it, so for example, we can talk about impermanence. We can talk about the way Buddha describes how we, you know, according to this way Atisha is presenting, this particular Indian scholar, you know, you might know every single day, you might think of it 1,000 times a day, death is definite, death is definite, time and death is uncertain. You grab yourself, you catch yourself every second. And that's still intellectual knowledge until, and actually it's quite, to have a direct experiential realization of any of these things, it's almost like you can't have a direct, okay, how to say it? All you can do is progressively develop the theoretical understanding and then apply it as much as you can at your own level according to your own pace. And eventually when you are able, it's almost like when you've got, okay, how to say it? Yeah, if you're learning music, you could pass your grade one exam. But let's say you get to grade five. When you go back and play your grade one music, you'll play it much better, won't you? So it's almost you could argue that you didn't really have a realization at all at grade one, but you pass certain set of laws to get through the exam. But as you keep progressing, your grade one keeps improving, your grade two keeps improving, and by the time you get to be the best musician in the universe, your grade one is like the most radiant music in the universe. It's like that with this as well. So levels of realizations even will continue to grow. So it's very incremental. It's very incremental. And it's just constantly, the more, first you learn the theories, and the more you think about and analyse, because the difference here is, it's easier to distinguish, like I said, between knowing theoretical musical theory and playing music. You can't fool yourself. But here it's very easy to fool ourselves, because it's just different parts of our mind. One part of the mind knows the theory, and then the deeper part of the mind knows the experience. And we just have to keep practising at it and becoming familiar with it. And then the bottom line, the criterion of success in really realizing to some degree impermanence, is when your beloved dies, it's not surprising. That sounds pretty shocking. That sounds like you're cold-hearted, because we're supposed to be shocked and devastated and distraught and take ages to grieve. But when you really understood impermanence, this is the whole point. The Buddha would say we are shocked by death because we don't believe in impermanence. We're grasping at permanence. So the more we believe in permanence without even realizing it, the more horrified we are when our beloved dies. But the more you've thought about impermanence, the sign of success is when you lose your handbag, when your boyfriend leaves you, to the degree that you suffer. That's the degree to which you haven't yet realized it. But the degree to which you suffer less is also the degree to which you've realized it. So that's the proof of the pudding. And so you just learn to become super familiar with your own mind and your own understanding of yourself and where you're at with everything. Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah? You think so, Louise? Good. It was a really important point. In other words, the sign that you've given up anger or you've really controlled your anger is when attachment does not get what it wants and you're able to work with it right there. So you can know all the theory beautifully, but then as soon as your boyfriend doesn't do what you want, you freak out and get angry. So that shows where you're at. So that we might notice it until you don't, and even see with attachment, because it's so primordial, we don't even notice we've got attachment until it doesn't get what it wants. And that's, so in other words, when the person dies, when you lose your things, when your house burns down, when you're told you get cancer, they're the signs. Then you can see where you're at. Then you can see where you're at. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Buddha's saying, don't wait till those times. Practice beforehand, you know. Deal with the baby things first. Like learn to stop being angry when you just, I always think of the dumb example of when you're washing the dishes. I don't think I know anybody who, if they break a cup, doesn't get upset with themselves. That's a mini moment of anger. So practice there. Don't wait for your boyfriend to leave you before you stop getting angry. Practice not being annoyed with yourself because you broke a cup. Little baby times, the baby examples, you understand? And they're really good tests. So we looked at the kind of the overview, and then we've touched upon a bit the different approaches to working on your mind, as well as internalizing these philosophical views which we often wouldn't think of as practice, thinking about how things are impermanent, thinking about karma. They seem very abstract to us, you know, but they play a massive role. If we choose, of course, you don't have to take these views, but from the Buddhist perspective, they play a massive role in how you practice Buddhism. Because why we suffer, Buddha says, much of our suffering is because we don't have the view of cause and effect. because we think we're an innocent victim who got made by somebody else. He said that. He says that belief, and it's a belief. We haven't proved it. It's a major source of our pain and suffering. So then all of this is preparing us, as we've been talking, to then, as we lessen our own neuroses, we're already, as we're doing that, we're breaking down the barriers that ego grasping and attachment have constructed between self and other. So when we get into the actual compassion wing techniques and practices, we're not doing any different job. We continue to do the exact same job of working on our mind. That never changes. But now the emphasis is different. In the first stages of practice, we're learning, it's like playing safe. We're learning to refrain from doing ridiculous things because we are sick of suffering and we do not want suffering. So we're like the wisdom wing, like I like to call it the retreat mode, is fundamentally necessary. And that's working on the mind. But it's mainly playing safe, not harming, not killing, not stealing, not lying. You know, the actual job you're doing is stopping causing yourself further suffering. Incidentally, others will benefit from our presence. But now we shift the emphasis when we start to do the compassion wing approach, and we now actively try to continue to work on our mind, but the emphasis now is on continuing to radically break down the barriers that prevent us from even wanting to help others. So all these different techniques over the centuries, you know, coming from from India and then to Tibet. So there's one approach that's got 11 little techniques, you know. And these are things that you easily do in a retreat. You also do these in a retreat. This is also the compassion wing, but you do these in a retreat as well. You could easily, very quickly do them in a retreat. Then they qualify you in your daily life. So the very first one, as I said, what we're trying to do in the compassion wing is now begin to develop, actively, proactively develop this wish that others be happy, which is love, and this wish they not suffer, which is compassion. So we're trying to expand our mind hugely beyond the tiny group we have now, innocent victims and a few friends, to try to include everybody. So the starting point has to be to radically shift the logic for why we would want others to be happy and want them not to suffer. And right now with ego, we only want beloveds to be happy and not suffer. We do our best with others, but there's not much logic for it, not according to ego. But here, we're starting to see how that's irrational, so we try to develop this equanimity. And we start to do this analysis, and even as we're talking, have right in front of you, eyeball to eyeball, an object of your aversion, to the left a beloved, to the right a stranger. So we use all these logical arguments to argue with ego's misconceptions. So right now, we see everybody in the universe through the lenses of attachment, aversion, and indifference. It seems almost shockingly simple when you analyze it. It is, and it's true. So we have, you know, attachment causes the friends to look gorgeous. Aversion causes the enemies, the ones who are mean and don't do what we want or have done what we don't want, to look ugly. And indifference causes the rest of the world to look boring. So we couldn't care less about them. We actively have aversion and even, you know, have to struggle not to hate the ones who've harmed us. And we have lots of love and compassion for the beloveds. But the love and compassion is contingent. As long as Tony keeps fulfilling my needs, I'm prepared for him to be happy and not suffer. So we're trying to get beyond that, and that's just shocking. So we're trying to show how there's no logic to that. So what we do is this equanimity contemplation. We get ourselves out of the equation. And we're trying to prove to ourselves this profound, simple but profound point that the person I label friend, the person I label enemy, and the person I label stranger are different in a myriad ways. They're different in relation to me. They're different in terms of their beauty, their ugliness, their goodness, their badness. Yes, they're so different. But from one perspective, we are trying to prove how they are identical to each other, which is that they all wish to be happy and all wish not to suffer. And that, when we start to get some sense of the truth of that, a realization of that, this is already profound. This becomes a profound basis for a completely new way of seeing sentient beings. In other words, you know, we can see right now If it was your beloved, if Viva's beloved was there crying out for some money to stay in the hotel, your lost daughter, you wouldn't just say, oh, I've got to get the train. You'd run like a magnet to her and miss six trains, wouldn't you? You just found your lost daughter. You'd give her, you know, you'd move her into your house, in fact. Because you've got a connection with her and she's an object of your attachment. And of course, when we hear that that's deluded, we get very upset. You mean that's, we call that normal. What do you mean? Of course it's normal to adore your own family. Of course it's normal to adore some people and not have... But no, Buddha says it's limited. It's due to the three poisons. It's due to attachment. No, it's not. Of course it's normal, but it's deluded. It's deluded. So this one, just equanimity, the first step, is shocking. So you hear, this is the thing now, you know, you hear the theory, then you can go on years in meditation. People go for years in meditation on these points, quickly realizing them. But we can do it every day. So as soon as you hear the logic of equanimity, like I said, how do you apply it? You're at the station. You're at the station, waiting for the train. Maybe there's a line, you know, or a queue. And straight away, a person who's pushy and kind of a pushy, rude person, you wouldn't want to get him in front. But a nice person, you put them in front because they make you happy. It suits you because they're humble. Straight away, we can practice 1,000 times a day. You just think to yourself that the ugly person, the nice person, no difference from my point of view. They're both as happy. They both want to be happy and both want to suffer. So why should I choose one over the other? Well, and purposely you choose, for your sake, you choose the one you don't like. Let them sit in front of you. You can practice this every single second of the day. As soon as you hear it, equanimity. Wow, friend, enemy, stranger, same as each other. They want to be happy, they want to suffer. Wow, all day you could practice that. It's sublime, it's profound. You see my point? Equanimity, you know. That's an incredible one. But you've got to remember it. We forget. Because default, we go back to the default, you know, which is what I want. And that's where the practice is too, where you're at with it. Let's say you think you've heard, you've just been to the teachings, you've heard about equanimity, it was moved you to tears, amazing, I can't believe all sentiments are the same as each other, want to be happy. Then the test is when you're at the station and you're in the line. Well, uh-oh, failed that one. Try again. That's it, you know. So there's a series of little techniques. This series of little things that over the centuries these yogis have cobbled together as a series of techniques that you could indeed spend years of retreat in, and each one leads to the next. Each one gets more expansive, more progressive as you go. So the next one is hilarious, you know. I'm not sure it suits you because you're not interested so much in other lives, are you? I forget your name again, darling. Was it Karen? You're not particularly into other lives, are you?
No, I think this one should suffice.
What?
I think this one should suffice me.
I can't hear you, Karen. Yes.
Yes.
What's the answer? You're not particularly...
Yeah, I'm not particularly...
No.
I think this should suffice.
This what?
Should suffice me.
Should? What do you mean by should?
Yeah.
Because what you want is only that. So then you'll be bored by the next step, then you won't be interested. Because all this... You see, this is the thing...
Charming.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'm going to say it anyway. You're not going to... Whether you like it or not, I mean, what can I say? I only give the teaching that I know, which is that from the big picture point of view. So the next little one, it's a bit hilarious. You need your calculator for this next little step. And you can apply it in your own way, in your way, in one life. But it goes like this. It goes all sentient beings, all the countless trillions of them, in all the realms of existence, have been my mother. And you think, excuse me, what? Well, it's sort of, I thought it was a mathematical certainty, but when I was here a couple of years ago and there was a mathematician... Was it here?
It was last year, was it? Was it just last year?
No, it was a while ago.
Was it?
I'm sure.
I don't remember.
I thought...
Was it last year?
No, anyway, he thought this was a stupid idea. I thought it was logical. But if there are countless sentient beings,
exactly.
And if we've all got countless lives, and we're all beginningless, it follows logical we've all bumped into each other countless times. He said a load of rubbish. And he emailed me a couple of times and he gave up, you know, he couldn't be bothered.
Was it Cesare? Was it Cesare, the mathematician from Leeds?
Was it?
Italian, yeah.
Was it him? No, I think it was him.
Exactly.
I'm not sure, I can't remember.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Anyway, so what's the point of this? The point of this is, if our mind is beginningless, and we've all met countless, we've all had countless lives, and it seems logical to me we've all bumped into each other countless times, which means we've all been each other's mother countless times. So why mother? Because for the Asians, it's kind of an example of a person who's kind of nurtured you and taken care of you. But unfortunately, in our culture, we probably think that mother's the cause of our suffering. It's a bit shocking to think that all people have been our mum. What's supposed to do with that, you know? So the next little third point is, therefore, to then contemplate. And this is a very kind of, this seems so simple, but this is kind of a profound exercise. There's two parts to number three. There's 3A. 3A goes, the mother is kind. So logically, they've all been your mum, they've all been kind to you. So the mother is kind. What do you do with that, you know? Well, I think it's a very, very interesting exercise. Because if we, most of us, have the view that our mother made us, and it's quite a strong belief we have. We really do believe it's true. It's our scientific view says it, and we believe it. So naturally, because of that view, we have all these assumptions of attachment that she should be a perfect mother. I think it's a very fascinating point. We have a deep assumption that our mother should be perfect. So when you read all these people, read their books about their mother being terrible and how they've harmed them, it's profoundly shocking to us that our mother has harmed us. But you've got to ask the question, why? Why is your mother? Why are we shocked by that? Because there's an assumption, a hunger in our being, and an assumption that somehow if she made me, she ought to be perfect. I mean, it's truly fascinating. Well, there's no logic to it. There's no logic whatsoever, but we think there is. But maybe if you think that she didn't make you, it is a pretty good expectation. It's a reasonable expectation to think that she'd become a proper person first. Go and do a bit of wisdom wing first before she starts making me. Isn't it? But she doesn't. Just leaps into bed and has sex with some wacko guy. And out I come. And it's her fault. I mean, my God, no wonder we're shocked. But, you know, but so here we're trying to, what we're trying to do here, it's a very different, I think it's a very different approach to the word kind. I think, again, our word, it's very loaded for us now. And I think when we say someone is kind, what we mean is they just did what my attachment wanted. It's a totally self-centered view of kindness. Oh, she's, you know, you go to the cafe, she gives you a discount and an extra piece of cream on the lovely cake. Oh, you're so kind, you will say. Even though she thinks you're an idiot and joking about this fat old Buddhist nun behind your back. You don't care because you got extra cream and a discount. You're so kind, we'll say. I mean, let's say she's depressed and in tears because, you know, her boyfriend just left her and the cake is ugly and she didn't cook it. We won't think she's kind. So our view of kindness is so self-centered. So what do we mean by here then? It's a very interesting approach that the very fact that, let's say, in the case of your mother, as an example, and then we can go to 3B, which is every sentient being is kind. That's even more ridiculous initially. We'll go into that. The mother is kind. I think it's a really powerful exercise to simply start thinking, like make lists, especially if you don't think your mother's kind. And indeed, your mother might have been mean to you. I'm not saying she hasn't been. But what happens is, because we have attachment exaggerates all the delicious qualities. And so, and when you have aversion exaggerates the ugly quality. So we all know, you know, when you think a person's gorgeous, you see only their good qualities. So like in the beginning, probably, we're in love with our mum. I mean, it was like I was in love with my mother. My mother was perfect. I remember thinking my mother was, I remember the first time I started to find fault, it was like the most shocking thing. I was like 12 or something. I mean, these days, you're 4 years old, you criticise your mother, isn't it? You want to sue them and divorce them. But I remember it was a shocking moment when I first time I ever found fault with my mother. It was the first time she fell off the pedestal. And it was downhill from there. Once you start, and that's what the relationships, once you start fighting every day and before you know it, all you do is fight. All you do is see the ugly qualities in the person. It's shocking, you know. So it's a really powerful exercise to think of the good things that your mother has done for you. Even if she's self-centered, she's depressed, she's an alcoholic, I don't care. The fact that you're alive is a good example of she must have done some good things. Even your mother gave you away at birth. I think that's one scenario in which we would absolute with certainty never think that our mother did anything kind whatsoever. Well, I'm sorry, you're wrong. She didn't abort you. That's a truth, you know. That's incredible. If someone just saved your life by pulling you out from under a bus, you'd never forget them as long as you live. But your mum didn't abort you. That's a fact. I remember a person I know who, when we were all younger, you know, in the 60s, and me and my friends and siblings, we had abortions, you know. And one person we knew, oh, no, no, she wanted, oh, it's easy, have an abortion. No, no, she didn't want. She risked losing her boyfriend. She decided consciously she would not have an abortion. She gave birth to that baby and then gave it away. Now, that girl, I'm sure, never thinks for one second that that kind person who has suffered terribly, a sense of loss and sadness, giving that daughter away, that she would ever think she was kind. Not for one second. And many people who have been given away feel this terrible sense of being abandoned, don't they? This person I know, she made a conscious decision not to abort. That I bet that daughter never thinks about it. It's very interesting. So there's so many things. And then what happens is, when you have a good picture of somebody, they look lovely. When you remember all their good qualities, and they're so lovely, and your darling mother, and she's so kind, she looks so beautiful to you. But when she starts to do bad things, then they take over, and now the whole picture is an ugly picture, and you forget the good things. So it's really profound practice, I think, to remember the good things. And so in other words, what you're doing when you do that is you're painting a new picture of your mother, and suddenly she'll start to appear present to you. Because your mind, you see her through your mind. When you see her through your attachment, she looks gorgeous. When you see her through your aversion, she looks ugly. So try and change that picture. It's a very profound exercise. And then the second one is a different approach. It's really based on dependent arising. It goes, all beings are kind. I mean, that's patently absurd initially. So what's it mean? It's scientifically true that, and this is a way of putting what this view is, that from the time we are conceived up to now, there is nothing that has facilitated our life that isn't the result of actions of countless sentient beings. This is a fact. Just think of anything you've got, your pair of glasses, your jumper, your knickers, your socks. You start to think of all the sentient beings who've been involved in those, it'll blow your mind. And this is fact. This is scientific fact. But whoever thinks like that? You know, but we understand the meaning. Like if you've got a beloved child, I know my mother, she had 7 children, and she kept everything we ever did, gave her, drew, wrote, touched. Mothers do that, right? So everything, whenever she saw this little silly old picture of her little Bobsy when she's 5 years old, she didn't see an ugly-looking photo, an ugly-looking picture. Like if you saw it in an op shop, you just chuck it out. It's boring. But when my mother saw that, she just saw her. It was vibrating with the beauty of her little daughter. That's how bodhisattvas think eventually when they've accomplished this one. Whatever they see, it's the handiwork of sentient beings. Like their most precious child made it. So they just... Everything triggers their sense of connection with others, you know, and therefore the wish to help sentient beings, all of them. So what these techniques are doing, you know, generosity, it's right, is a direct action you can do with your hands. But all of these practices are just methods. They're internal. They're methods of breaking down the misconceptions and the obstacles that prevent us from even wanting to be generous. This is the point, you know. So by changing our way of seeing sentient beings, by, you know, you look at the cup. We go to a restaurant. The restaurant's a typical example. Because we're driven by attachment now to get what I want. That's the driving force. Even though we're not monsters, it's still there. And there's an assumption when I go to a cafe I should be treated nicely and the menu should be nice and the person should be polite to me and the food should be hot and delicious and exactly what I ordered and everyone smiles at me and is delighted and then I'm prepared to pay for it and even prepared to give a tip. We have that assumption and it is lovely to be treated nicely. It's lovely to get a meal that you want. It's true. And we will praise the cook if the food is extra good because we're getting what we want. But what we should be trying to do is, whether we get what we want or not, to appreciate all the hard work, all the people, all the kindness, the people who did the food, the people who made the food, the people, the animals who died, like we did for our lunch. This is kind of profound, you know, to see not through the lens of my needs, but to see it through, as an example here, of, as the handiwork of the sentient beings. Like as if you saw something and it triggers and reminds you of your precious child. You see that little pair of gloves that she made you when she was 10. I mean, it would make you weep with an open heart. That's what we're trying to cultivate, this sense of connectedness with sentient beings. So all these 11 techniques are priming our mind to break down the misconceptions so that we get closer and closer and closer to sentient beings. You don't just do it in your mind, then you act it out during your daily life. You think of it every time. You go to the restaurant, you think of the kind people. And you can ask for a better piece of cake if you like. But if you don't, your mind won't be distressed because you'll think of the kindness of sentient beings. When you eat your lunch here, you'll think of the kindness. We can think of it if we think of it for a minute, but it doesn't come naturally. If it's our beloved who made the meal, yes. And that's a good example of what we're capable of. So these are all internal things, but all the... Because, in other words, the views in our mind now, whether on the wisdom wing or the compassion wing, we've got views in our mind that are limiting us. And on the base of changing those views, already your actions will be different. So if you're practicing even the first stages of controlling your speech, right there you're being kind to somebody. Merely refraining from saying an angry word, that second is practicing compassion, surely, isn't it? You see what I'm saying? The second you stop feeling angry and upset about your colleague at work because they were mean to you, that second you are helping your own mind, but immediately your response to your colleague tomorrow will be different. It'll be tempered by your work on your own mind, and you'll be more kind to her. So straight away, you don't just leave it in the mind. You don't just leave it as a mental practice. That would be very absurd. It's like leaving the recipe in the and never making the cake. So even as you're working on your mind, even as you're working on your body and your speech, already your actions will be different, which is compassion. Can you see what I'm saying? Less harming and more kind, straight away. And if it doesn't, then you're schizophrenic. If it doesn't affect you, that means you're just living in your head. You're thinking you're a cook because you know the recipes and you forget to make the cake. Then it's a problem. And that's a way of saying it, that's as an experience. If you put your money where your mouth is, every time you control your speech and don't say those angry words, that is a powerful action of kindness to someone else. It's very clear, isn't it? Do you see what I'm saying, Karen? You're reprogramming your way of seeing the world. And that informs what you do with your body and speech. No question. So every second of it is doing that. Yeah.
So how do you... I understand exactly what you're saying, but how... If your colleague at work was... mean to you.
That's
every
right.
Single day.
Exactly.
Should there come a point?
I understand.
You say, excuse me.
I understand. I understand totally.
Put up with it for the rest of your
exactly.
Life.
I understand. This is where it has to be where you're at.
Yes.
So let's just, you know, whether it's the colleague at work or your boss or your boyfriend, it's exactly the same, you know. So right now, if we take ourselves as an ordinary person, which is really what the victim is, we're all victims, and that's not being horrible, but we all think we're made by somebody else, we all think it's not fair, we all think we deserve happiness, we all think we don't deserve suffering, we get upset, we get angry, we get hurt, we get resentful. In other words, we're really cut off from ourselves, which is a way of saying it. That's why we suffer. So at that first level, you don't even know what to do when your colleague is mean to you. You're so brokenhearted, you're so hurt, you're so offended, and depending on your personality, you'll either internalize it and get depressed, or you'll get volatile and angry and curse and shout and yell to everybody else maybe, and then one day you might explode to her, you know. But you'll be full of anger and resentment and how dare, and it's not fair. So you'll become utterly miserable. So at that level, let's say already it's different. Let's say you're a person who doesn't express themselves. So maybe your practice is to speak up. Maybe that's what you have to practice. A person like me, I'd probably have to practice not speaking up because I speak up easily. Do you understand? See, even there you've got to know where you're at and what it is you need to do. So let's say in a relationship with Tony, for example. You know, full of attachment and this neediness that he's got to make me happy. It's his job, and I believe it totally, and then I expect it, and I manipulate him to do it, and when he doesn't, I get upset, and then I get jealous, and then paranoid, whatever, where my mind's at, you know? So at that first level, this is what happens. Then let's say your job, and you hate your job. You go home every day, and you're angry at the job, and it's a horrible job, and that boss is awful, and the colleague is awful. We're paralyzed. That's the victim one. We are paralyzed. I might say, well, you know, darling, you could change the job if you liked. But you'd be shocked What do you mean, change the job? Why should I? I shouldn't change. They should change, and the colleagues should change. Meanwhile, you're still miserable. Well, I say, well, then, you know, if you're not going to change your mind, not going to change the job, then maybe you've got to, if you're going to decide to do, and that's what I'm saying, the victim doesn't decide. You just get become like a lemming. But if you become, start to grow, that means you've got to make a decision. Okay, I'm deciding to stay in this job. So that means you now got to change your mind and start finding some good things about it so you can be happy. But we can't do that either. So that's what a victim is. We can't even change the job and we can't decide to change our mind. We stay being a victim, really just attached to our misery, which is how we are. So that's the victim mentality. We've got to start shifting something. So the best thing, if you can't change your mind, which is much more difficult, then leave the job. That's incredible responsibility. Leave the relationship. But most of us don't. We sit there until he murders me. We sit there until we just go crazy. And this is how hopeless we are, how paralyzed we are. So you've got to know where you're at. Now, if you've made a decision, which is already pretty brave, okay, this is not the best job, but I'm going to make the most of it. So I'm going to try and see the good things about it. So then the consequence of this is what? That you become more happy. And then within that framework, you're going to accept, okay, the colleague is this way. This is quite advanced. You're going to learn to put up with it because you've decided you're going to live with this job because every job is not perfect. Every relationship is not perfect. There's always going to be something. But the real one is to own, to take responsibility for some action, physical or mental. Then you're in charge of your life. Then you're brave enough. And then you decide that this is just the way the job is. And then you might say something to the colleague, which you try and make it useful. But and then what happens if she doesn't change? Again, back to square one. What are you going to do about it? And we can see very clearly in our lives we cannot change many things. So what's the point of staying miserable? That's the point. If you can change something, please change it. But what if you can't? That's when your choices come. So it's all a question where you're at. But if the real one, the way I'd put it is, you start becoming responsible, accountable, and you make some decisions to either, you've got two options, leave the job or stay. And if you stay, change your mind. This is profound. Same with a relationship. But we never get to the point. We just moan, complain, get upset, blame. I'm not being mean about us. And we're paralyzed. So this is why the compassion wing approach to your colleague is profound. The compassion wing approach to your ugly colleague who is being mean to you, the most advanced level in the Bodhisattva path, is there's a whole level of practice, and you want practice, honey, I'm going to give you some now, Karen. This is the higher level of practicing this stuff, is you learn to be glad to have problems. And why would you be glad to have a problem? Because the problem is called attachment and anger. So every time somebody activates your attachment and anger and you're trying to really practice, you will be glad for the opportunity to smash your ego. Now, that's real advanced. If you're at the state where you're a complete victim, this is not your practice. It's too advanced. But as you progress and as you've decided to put up with this job, you're going to see the most of it because you're going to grow from it. There's something to some benefit in it. Then you start to really develop the brave attitude. You can ask her to stop saying it. She might, but I bet she doesn't. And if she doesn't, then you've got some options here. And it's going to be a really profound test for your practice. And it mightn't look to anybody else that you're doing anything very generous and lovely, but you're powerfully working on your mind and therefore having more love and compassion for her. But it's up to where you're at.
Does there not become a point when, I mean, I'm talking about somebody who's continually abused.
Darling, I am too! I am too!
Does there not come a point where, by continually, in her eyes, ignoring her behaviour or letting her get away with that behaviour, that is not showing her compassion because it's not teaching her anything?
That's not your job to teach. We're talking about you.
Or help her.
We're talking about you helping yourself first. What do you think he's running around trying to help people for when you're a peanut? You can't even bear your problems. You can't even bear the unhappiness that she triggers and you want to go around helping her. Excuse me. Your job is not to help her. Your job is to learn to practice. And if you really want to do the most advanced level, you learn to see her abuse as good. This is an advanced level of practice, honey. And only then are you qualified to help her. We love to help everybody, which we all do all day. I shout and yell at Tony for his sake. Ha, ha, ha. It's not true. It's for our own sake. It's for our own sake. It's for our own sake we do those things.
So what would it be then if you slightly changed it and this person was getting at somebody else who was vulnerable on a daily basis?
Well, usually they are. Usually people are. But one of our biggest problems in our life, I think, we run around trying to sound all noble and we say we're doing it for other people's sake. For example, I use the most brutal examples, but let's say, your child has been murdered. I notice that people whose child have been murdered or child has been raped, they're the ones who start foundations to help other people. But how come you didn't bother before your child was murdered? We couldn't care less about anybody else. So it's not true you're trying to help everybody else. It's because it's now your trip. We do that. It's not for other people's sake. It's for our own sake. Because we suddenly notice now our child got murdered and we start noticing all the other children got murdered, but we didn't see it before. We couldn't have cared less before. So, of course, there's some aspect of compassion there. But mainly, this is the point here, and it's including on the compassion wing, the work we're trying to do is to rip out our delusions. This is a very powerful level of practice in meditation and then in daily life. To control your body, to control your speech, and then to control your mind. And then to be able, on the basis of that, to have the wisdom to know, and that's the point now. At work, depending on where you're at your level of practice, is only that would inform how you can help this woman. So if you're so overwhelmed by your own pain and your own hurt and your own resentment and your own jealousy, you're not qualified to help her because all you do is see her as a creep. And even if you do try to help her, it's coming from your anger and your hurt. It's impossible to help her. But if you have more together in yourself, you're more patient, you understand she's got a problem and it doesn't hurt you anymore, then you're qualified to help her because it's coming from a compassionate place for her. But that's very rare. That's advanced practice. Can you see my point?
Yeah.
It's not easy. We all get hurt by each other and then we think we're trying to help other people by telling them off. Going to the boss, blah, blah, blah. It just makes more poison, more misery. It's really intense. So if we can be brave enough to bear all the problems, but mostly we're not, that's why if you can't bear it, leave the job. But we think, well, why should I? She's the problem. But you're going back like moth to a flame every day. And that's what we do in our relationships. What do you mean I should leave Tony? He should change. And meanwhile, I keep going back. He keeps beating me. I mean, we're demented. We're so disconnected from ourselves. This is where in an ordinary relationship, work or relationship, it's the same thing. If you can, there's always going to be something that someone will do that's not right. We all know that. Because life is not perfect. So then we've got to look at what we can bear and learn to accept, because it might be good qualities about the job, but you've got this one colleague. But you know that changes, because she could leave, then another one can come. Maybe you just solved it with her, and then a new one comes, and off you go again. So that's why, until you've worked on your mind, we'll keep meeting the same problems. And that's hard to see, because we think we're this innocent victim, and then there are problems that happen to us innocently. But every problem that we have is completely related to the delusions we've got. Because if you didn't have a lot of attachment, you wouldn't be upset by that. If you didn't have jealousy, it wouldn't matter what Tony did. If I didn't have anger, I wouldn't be disturbed. We don't realise that. So the reason from our side why our colleagues upset us, and they might be a creep, I agree, is because we've got delusions. So by working on our own mind, we help ourselves, and then we are capable of from compassion helping her. And that could also be tough love. But it's got to have an element of wanting to help her. It's got to be, otherwise it's just vindictive. Like your child. You know, a mother who's just only got attachment for her child, she'll let them get away with murder. That's not kindness, that's just weak. But a mother who's got real, genuine caring for the child will be prepared to be tough and say no and have the kid rant and rave because it's coming from a genuine place of caring for that person. So if we can help a person with that level of compassion, go for it, baby. But you can't have that level of compassion until you've got some semblance of sanity and less attachment and anger in your own mind. So it's a question of where we're at every time. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
So none of this is easy. It's full-on, intense, hard work. And the more you work on your mind and not get upset and not get angry, and this is really intense, then the less she will concern you, and then eventually you'll only have compassion for her because you'll see she's this ridiculous, neurotic, bitter, unhappy person who's harming herself. Then you'll afford to have compassion. But you can't see that till you've done some work on yourself. Do you understand? And every day we're going to meet these examples. Every single day, wherever we go, because we have attachment and aversion, we're going to be meeting people all the time who trigger our attachment and aversion. This is the story of the universe, you know.
there's something about bad things happen. I think maybe that's something that
yes.
Pam's saying. It's almost like you can be in a situation, there's a lot in the care world, like you were talking about, in old people's home, and you're just seeing so much bad stuff happen. I don't know where this is going, but it's something similar, and you can see people perpetrating the bad stuff.
Yes.
It's how do you deal with that? Because you've got the people that are really vulnerable.
That's right.
That mm-hmm. bad stuff is happening.
That's right.
So you've got the people in power.
Yes, exactly.
Who are doing the bad stuff. Those people in power are part of some major system that is completely...
Yes, exactly, exactly. I know, it's very hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm just thinking of now one of my sisters in Australia who became a lawyer later in life, and she's now 70, like, I think she's 70, no, a bit less than 70, and she became a lawyer like 10 years ago, and now she's full on very well known in Australia because she's dealing with the victims of the Catholic Church. And I mean, talk about entrenched abuse. It's unbelievable. You can't even begin to find a way to help, you know? But all you can do is do something. All you can do is do something and chip away and do what you can. But it's got to come from a wish to... It's got to come from patience and humility and perseverance, because it's not possible to change systems that are 1,000 years old just overnight.
There's something about ego in there, isn't it? I think perhaps we all want to be bigger than we are and have more impact than we have.
What do you mean? Sorry, I'm lost now.
No. I'm just hearing that we can just do what we can, the little bit that we can.
All we can do is that.
And we kind of want to change the system.
No, that's right. And that's what I found by working with people in prison. You know, as a Buddhist, it was kind of ironic when I was living in London in the 60s and early 70s, and I was working in then radical lefty politics and dealing with, you know, supporting people in American prisons. It's kind of ironic. There I was, you know, ready to kill the pigs and have revolutions and all that stuff. And then I became a Buddhist, and then I was 20 years later, 30 years later, working in California in the same prisons, working one-on-one. So this prison system in California, I can't even begin to describe the nightmare. In the whole of America, it's an entrenched nightmare. You can't begin to find the beginning of it. It's so massive, so massive. So you'd go mad trying to work on it politically. I don't even know how I can even begin. So then for me, I was working personally, one-on-one, with one prisoner at a time, giving them books and helping them and giving them advice. I couldn't get them out of prison. I didn't have the money. I didn't have lawyers. So we helped individual prisoners. And what we did was, by using Buddhist tools, giving these guys who wanted it the tools that I'm using myself to help their minds be less crazy while they're in these crazy prisons. So it was when I really started to think about it, helping people one-on-one, we probably began to touch the lives of thousands of people, because that book would be shared by one other person. He'd share his meditation technique with his mate. I mean, each person affected another person. So it's a slow but effective, profound way, starting on the inside and individuals in there helping each other. So it's not so dramatic looking, but it's very profound. It's by helping one person, and that's the bodhisattva one pretty much. Whoever's in front of you, the ant, the dog, the rat, the mouse, the crazy person, all this stuff comes to fruition in the way you help that person right there, based on the work you've done, based on the generosity you've got, your capability, your insight, you help that person. And it's one-on-one, not being like being Mother Teresa's. You can do that too. But it's profound to do that. But we like to have big sweeping things, but... It's too hard, you know. One-on-one, it can slowly influence, slowly change. Yeah. Go. Sweetheart, was that your hand? Nobody's hand. Okay. So then all these little techniques culminate in this amazing technique that's... This whole practice, one whole approach to this more advanced level of this compassion practice, developing compassion, is called exchanging self for others. And eventually that's what this bodhicitta is, where you've gone through these stages of practice, where eventually, literally, not just occasionally, but stably, as a result of years and years of practice, if not lifetimes, you now literally have gotten to this point where others are more important than you. Now, this is, in our ordinary world of psychology, sounds like a mental illness. It sounds like a really demented person. But this is where we have to look at this view that Buddha's got, that we can eventually rid the mind utterly of self-centeredness, of attachment, of aversion, delusions, of selfishness, to the point where doing all this work for years and years and years in retreat and meditation in your daily life, you eventually got such unbelievable affection and love and compassion for every sentient being, stable, not just occasionally, not like an emotional feeling. You've done the inner work continuously. That now others are, this bodhicitta, one of the criteria of having accomplished, there are several criteria, and the one criterion of having accomplished bodhicitta is no longer the thought of this normal self. That's almost inconceivable for us in psychology. It's like bizarre. Because the I that runs the show now, this sense of I that runs our universe, it runs our head. I am the central player, isn't it? So to have no longer this thought, the neurotic thought of I getting something from me, that no longer exists in these beings' minds. I mean, this is too even absurd to think of as a possibility, but this is where all this stuff's going. We've got this capacity. So then now you just, it's sort of like you've become the perfect mother. Every being is your child. And like a mother, it's a good example. Okay, they're driven by attachment, but a mother knows. There's never one second when a mother forgets her job. She doesn't see that baby and go, God, who's taking care of that baby? No, she knows it's her job, you know. It's like, bodhisattvas are like that. They know it's their job description, that sentient beings are their job. So whoever they meet, automatically, they're capable and having the wisdom as well to know the mind, and so at whatever level, able to help others. So bodhisattvas aren't people who run around being like big Mother Teresa's or do big, magnificent political movements. They might also, but it's one-on-one, one sentient being at a time, one sentient being at a time, giving them fully whatever it is they need according to their capacity and knowing how to help them. So once you've accomplished bodhicitta, this next phase of practices, then you go from life to life to life, perfecting these six perfections. The first four are what you do in relation to sentient beings bopping around from life to life: generosity, helping others. They call that ethics, the ethics or the morality of helping others, and then practicing patience in the face of problems, and this practice of incredible perseverance. This is what then perfects, you know, your compassion wing, and then in your meditation, in your daily life, you perfect the wisdom wing. You get perfect concentration, and then you cut the root of all delusions by realizing emptiness. This is where you finally finish the two wings of the bird, you know. And then you become this bodhisattva, this Buddha. Of course, this is so long-term, it's a joke. So you're fully capable now of benefiting whoever needs to be benefited, life after life after life. But if, you know, if Karen wants it just in this life, then if you achieve Buddhahood, Karen, you'd have perfect wisdom. You see the minds of all beings. You'd be able to do whatever needs to be done for all of them. But you'd be doing a million lot more, but that doesn't apply to you because you don't like other lives. But you'd have the ability to manifest in many bodies, and you'd be doing whatever needs to be done for all sentient beings. All these years and years and years of training, you've now graduated. So now you keep bopping around helping sentient beings till the cows come home. Perfectly, because no longer delusions. And it's effortless, and you're joyful as well. That's the bonus. You can't get miserable again. Not possible. That sounds all right, doesn't it? Time for a tea break. Time for some kind of break. Yeah, have a break. See you soon.